session number 28650 with Gordon Mellor, Real 15. Now, what about these Halifax, Handy Page Halifax? What was it like as an airplane? It's a Mark 1, obviously, compared to...
Mark 2, actually.
Oh, Mark 2, alright, yeah. Sorry, there wasn't a Mark 1 in the book, but I see what
is it?
It's a Mark 2, that was fine. What was it like as an airplane, comparing, you know, with what you were used to?
Spacious. it looked heavy. It hadn't got the trim lines of a Wellington. Yes, it looked like a workhorse to do a job.
Were there any ways it was better than the Wellington?
Well, of course, you've got more with four engines. You've got more speed. You've got two Pegasus on the Wellington, and they were about 980 horsepower. And you come on with four Merlins, and they were somewhere around about 1200, I suppose, horsepower. So you've got more than double the power. You've got a lot heavier load to be carried, which it lifted, and the accommodation was far easier to cope with, I thought, than it was on the previous aircraft.
And where was everybody in the plane?
Well, shall we start at the nose? It obviously was at that time there was a front gunner. He got a turret with two guns in it. These were gradually phased out, I understand, and sometimes they had a Perspex nose instead of the turret, and there was one gun firing from a fixed position in the nose. But with us, we had the standard turret there, and then immediately behind that position, there was what you might call an office. There was a trap door in the floor, and close to that was the navigation table of quite generous proportions, I thought. You had a G-box and astrograph and a few other bits and pieces readily available. And then there was some steps up to a floor above. And underneath that sort of landing, if we can call it, there was a position for the radio operator, and he had his all equipment round him, so that his he sat facing the wall of the aircraft, and he was underneath the platform, and he had the stairs at his back, or steps at his back. I faced the same way as him, so we could pass a message backwards and forwards quite easily. It was done in writing if he gave me a course or a bearing or something he had acquired in his searching on the airwaves. And he wrote it down so that we've made no mistake. Then up the steps onto this landing, which was then the main platform of the aircraft. There was the pilot sitting virtually above the radio operator, and the second pilot had a position laid on for him, and immediately behind him, also facing the starboard side, I think, yes, starboard side, was the flight engineer's position with all his dials for all the engines. There was a set of dials for each engine, and he checked on fuel consumptions and how much there was in the tanks, and all the things that go with managing operating engines. The pilots and the flight engineers were standing on the roof of the bomb bay underneath. The steps had been put there because that was there, the position was the front of the bomb bay. You then went along, and there was a mid-upper gunner. Not quite sure how far back he was. He was along the spine of the aircraft anyhow, and the type of turrets that were fitted did vary to a certain extent. There was Bolton & Paul, Fraser Nash, and another sort, I think. And going from the mid-upper gunner's position, then on either side of the fuselage was the tracks, which had the ammunition belts along them, and that was for feeding the four guns in the rear turret. there was a flare chute. There was a toilet can. I can't say whether there was a bed there or not. There certainly was on the Wellingtons. I mentioned that. That was, of course, it was in case there was a casualty or something. But I can't recall whether there was in the Halifax. I'm feeling there must be, because on takeoff we all sat away from our position, so there had to be something for us to sit on in the middle of the aircraft. Possibly something like a bench or a bed. As you see, it's very spacious, and there was plenty of room to move about. But the two gunners, the mid-upper and the rear gunner, were quite isolated, other than by the intercom. And the main sort of way of flying the plane and where it went was confined into a little suite in the nose.
I should have asked about intercom. Was your crew a wireless, an intercom silence, you know, plane, or was it one that chattered away?
No, they were down to business. They might chatter a bit on that last stretch back towards base on a sort of, you know, nice morning, but if it was foggy and you were enveloped in cloud or something, then they were pretty quiet. And so during the raids, what would come out, what they would say is if there was a night fighter hovering around anywhere, or whether they saw one of our planes going down in flames, or some if the Germans had a contraption they used to fire up from the ACAC, and it, from a distance it looked like a plane going down in flames. It was pyrotechnic of some sort, but that was their main conversation on the intercom. Mostly it was the skipper who did any talking about what was going to happen or where we were and like, but he was pretty quiet on the whole too.
Now, so what happens next then? You have this period at Pocklington.
Yes. And then
you get back to the your squadron.
That's right.
Now what happens then? You seem to be recalled from leave. Yes. Were you sent on leave before you actually went back to operations?
Yes. What is the date of that?
Leave, it's August. 19th of August, you recall.
19th. That was probably when they started us back on ops. Yes, we'd done a fair bit of training one way and another. From July into August. And there's one or two of the leading lights of the squadron had done the odd op. And reported back on, you know, how they found the aircraft and the like. But during that period, now I'm not sure whether it was after we, I think it's during the August period, I was in the squadron adjutant's office. There was a couple of other officers there beside the adjutant, and we had a view out of his office there through the windows, down to one side of the aerodrome, and there was a Halifax circuiting. I would say it was 1,000 feet, not much more, and all of a sudden one of the officers that was standing by me was looking out the window and said, that plane's going to crash. I can't tell you what he said exactly. It was probably quite colourful, but that was the implication. And of course we all looked, and the nose had dropped, and the plane was in planned form for where we were standing in the room there, so that you could see all the wings, you could see the fuselage, and you could see the tailplane all in planned sort of view. And it just went straight down. Engines roaring, the pilot tried to sort of get the nose up, and Elsham Aerodrome was on an escarpment, and it runs along from Barnaby towards Barton on Humber, which is at the far end, and the escarpment drops 200 or 300 feet, and one of our runways finished just before the escarpment started, and there was a hedge there and a road there. So sometimes when we took off with a heavy load, we were lower 2 or 3 minutes after takeoff than we were when we actually took off from the runway. But this plane then disappeared behind the hedge, and it also, and suddenly it went quiet. And then, of course, you saw the plume of black smoke come up there, so we knew what had happened. And a fair number of people who were outside ran over there. I started to walk myself, but then I'd left it too late to go and have a look, really, because the two officers that I'd been talking to in the adjutant's office said, "You don't want to go and see that." So I didn't, and just as well, really. So, and that was put down to the a stalled situation on the twin rudders. I think there was an official investigation, and there was something about engine failure as well. But I didn't go there, but I they were all killed, and. Some 2 or 3 years back, there was a request for information to anybody who saw it in the squadron newsletter. And it so appeared that I was the only one available who actually saw it happen. So I met the family of one of the crew who was killed. And each year, we still see each other.
Now, when you were recalled from leave, you seem, there seems to have been a new crew or a good part of the crew.
Oh.
Are you in? Were you then in Q for Queenie, are you?
Yes. Our Wellington was called L for London. And I have got an illustration of it with his history on it. But this one was Q Queenie. And all the crews were changed. My pilot, Jack Murray, went to 460 Squadron, as he was Australian. I think our rear gunner did too. I'm not quite sure about that. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He went to an Australian squadron. And in actual fact, I was the was put with Warrant Officer Edwards.
K.F. Edwards.
Yes.
What's his name?
Kenneth. Yes.
Now, we'll just run through them if you remember them. Kenneth Edwards, what was he like? Old sergeants again, are they?
No. He was a warrant officer.
Oh, sorry. Yes, sorry.
He was a regular Air Force. He was. He had an Indian mother and an English Army officer or sergeant or something like that is his father. Anyhow, he was Anglo-Indian as such. It was not noticeable, really. He looked sunburnt more than anything else. His English was as perfect as any other person from Nottingham, Yorkshire, London, or wherever it was. We then had
a good pilot.
Oh, excellent! Yes, excellent. He'd got a vast number of hours in. He'd been warrant officer for quite some time, and if there was a plane to be, I think the groupie had a Tiger Moth or something like that. Whether it was allocated to him or his own, I don't know. But our pilot was sent down or taken down to pick it up from wherever it was lodged to bring it back, and I'm certain they picked one of the best pilots.
Now, you, of course, were the navigator, and then
yes.
The flight engineer was...
George Green.
George Green. Now, what was he?
He was a regular.
Sergeant or what?
He was sergeant, yeah. And there was a call for flight engineers with the advent of the four-engine bombers, and he volunteered. I don't know what rank he was before that, but he had been in the Air Force quite a long time. And he joined us, as did all the other flight engineers. There was one for each aircraft.
Of course, you hadn't had them before.
No, we hadn't. He came and joined us, and we then...
There's a wireless operator, Don McDonald.
Oh, Don, yes. He was a Canadian flight sergeant. He was near the end of his tour. He'd done about 24, 25 trips. He was a father figure. He was in his 30s. Is he there?
He's there, yeah.
That's him there, yes. Yes. I got on very well with Canadians, having been in Canada. I responded to them to a certain extent, and he was a very pleasant man. And we were all rehoused. We were taken out of the Nissen huts with the change in the aircraft, and in another set of the woods around the aerodrome, there were wooden huts built, and there was two people in each room.
Hang on, let me just finish the crew.
Part was he and I just shared the same room.
Now, you've got your air gunners. You've then got three air gunners. Norman McMaster.
Yes, he was the rear gunner. And he in actual fact, was a replacement, because the first rear gunner was a chap called Stoles Page. He again, was a regular. He had done a tour on... what was the aircraft that looked like a Spitfire, but it got a turret in it?
I don't know.
He was operating on that aircraft. I should have to look the name up. Defiant, I think it was
That's
called.
It. Yeah, I think it I is.
It was called Defiant. Well, he did a tour then, round about the time of Dunkirk and what have you, and he'd already got a score of against the German fighters. Whether it was one or two or not, I don't know now, but he'd already sort of opened the batting.
So there's Norman McMaster, Stoltz Page, and Stoltz Page and sort of replacement.
The replacement, yes.
And then Hawthorne, what's
his name? Twiggy Hawthorne.
Do you know his real name? No.
Yes, I do. Question is remembering it.
It's R.
Robert. Robert Hawthorne.
And these are all sergeants, these rear gunners?
He was a flight sergeant. He was a regular. And he was the front gunner. And bomb aimer as well. He'd done a bomb aiming course as well. He was Scots, by the way.
And then there's Ginger Richards.
H. Richards. That is this
Henry
chap.
Or?
Harry.
Harry.
Perhaps I'm pointing to the wrong one. That's Harry Richards, yes. He was Welsh. And he was a mid-upper gunner, sergeant.
Now, how did you get on with all this lot? I mean, how did it compare with your first crew?
The first crew damaged early on, so we were working together all right. And then we had replacements. Jack Murray joined us and what have you. And so that was really our second crew, and that we got on well. There was a mixture there with the South African and the Australians. These people were they gelled together. They certainly did. I think it was good that the regulars accepted the amateurs, so to speak.
Now, did you personalise your aircraft? I mean, I know you did, because there's a picture of you doing it. But I mean,
yes.
I hadn't asked you about the previous one, and so perhaps I should have done the L for London.
No, we didn't.
What made you personalise Q for Cuny?
Queenie. Oh, well, it was being done by a number of aircraft. I mean, the squadron leader, one of the flight commanders, had it personalised to a certain extent. You just had to take whatever letter was given to you, and it so happened that the aircraft that was allocated to our crew was Q, PMQ. So the only thing we could think of was a chess piece. So the other chaps couldn't think of anything better, so I said, all right, well, I'll do the I'll do a chess piece up there. It was a bit big, but appropriate. And then, of course, every raid we started putting up a pawn, nobody complained. It was, as you can see, it was done in yellow, but it was only a sort of room lighting of it, so we didn't really make a big splodge of a colour or a light colour to attract any aircraft from Germany. That was just a bit of a fad, I suppose.
So what happened to it with your new weapon? Well, you seem to have started with summer operations, daylight raids at first in August. What do you remember about this is in August, operations over Germany. Do you remember any of them in particular?
No, I don't. I'm sorry, it's I don't really remember much at all. It could only be one or two, perhaps, at most.
It looks like a couple, that's it. I mean, you says two of the August operations, Kassel, Nuremberg. That's what it looks like.
I wonder what I had in mind when I put all this together. Two of the August operations. When does it say daylight?
That was on the previous page.
I think that was a French thing that we did.
Ah, right.
I think that was the only one.
Okay.
I think that was the only
Anything
one.
Anything about the night raids over Germany, or are they just blurred with the others a bit now?
Individually, they I can't pick them out.
Was it any
they
different?
Generally they followed a pattern, to be quite honest, and we became familiar with it. So unless anything seriously happened to us, then they rather merge. Was That's why I haven't. I've got one or two mentioned there, but
was it similar in the Halifax? I mean, was there anything different about that using a Halifax?
From the navigational point of view, not really. You were in an aircraft, and the same principles applied. The Germans were getting a bit more ambitious with their jamming of the G box, so that you couldn't get a fix much beyond the coast of the occupied countries. They improved in their jamming quite considerably. So it got you out a part of the way, and it got you home. But it wasn't much good beyond there. What happened in the later years, I can't say.
So that's part reinforces what you said. It was just an aid to navigation
rather
than the be-all and end-all.
Yes, yes. It would be a nice one.
Any new techniques coming in for other than G? You know, anything new that you remember?
Well, we weren't fitted with any, but there was talk about H2S and one or two of these other systems.
Did you know what H2S was?
I mean, eventually I did, but I can't tell you when I first heard of it, because it may have been later in the year. And then it was sort of probably just in a conversation with another navigator somewhere.
Okay, well, we'll perhaps leave that. Anything else you remember? I mean, if you want to have a quick look through to remind yourself, there doesn't seem to be anything particular.
No, we're now coming up to October, aren't we? The photograph here gives an indication that Eddie, I think it was, had a car at the camp. The rest of us certainly didn't. I don't think anybody invested in a car there. The target maps were very much the same from one place to another, such as this, so that you would see this in the light of your bomb aimer's position. The red is there was the aiming point for that particular raid. But they very much followed a similar pattern, I would say, and we were lucky in as much as they did.
So what happened next then?
I think we'd better come perhaps to this period here.
Well, this is a rather dramatic
event. Well, it was a bit different from all the others.
Tell me the full story of that. Now, this is a raid on the 5th of October. Now, what was the target then that day?
The target was a place called Arkham, or the French call it Aix-la-Chapelle, home of Charlemagne, I think it was in the long ago.
It was Belgium, isn't it?
It's in Germany. It's not far in. Not far in at all. I'm guessing 30, 40 miles. Perhaps not much more, if that. And it certainly is not as far as the Ruhr. And we rather thought this was going to be a quick trip. Preparations were much the same as usual. Briefing in the afternoon for navigators, which we were given the route, which was unusual, in as much that instead of going out over the North Sea via Mapplethorpe or one of these other sort of recognisable points, we came straight down the country and passed just east of London and straight out over Kent down to the French coast. And we then did a right-hand turn and started at an angle down to a latitude and longitudinal point in France, and then on across Belgium in a long straight line, virtually direct for Arkham.
Do you remember the thunderstorms on the way?
Oh yes, having got that sort of general route laid out, then there'd been thunder sort of on the breeze round Elsham Wolds most of the afternoon, and when we had the main briefing, which rather indicated it was not one of the big raids at all, it was quite a small one, then the Met officer said, well, you may well find yourself passing through thunderstorms, which raised an ironic cheer from the from the crew, especially from the navigators. And other than that, he said it would be clear in front of the in Belgium and what have you, because this was a result of a front passing through, but that's as I seem to remember it. Anyhow, we went down past London, and there was no problems there, across the Channel, and then started our eastwards trek. We came out of cloud, and the sky was clear. And again on this particular trip, then the ACAC batteries in various places along the country were marking our route, and you could see, looking out of the side of the aircraft by the pilot's position, you could see the flak was at air level and appearing every couple of miles or so. So it was indicating to somebody that there was a aircraft approaching along that route. We saw one plane go down ahead of us. It had been attacked and suffered the inevitable. It went down in flames. I mean, we sort of made a note of that and pressed on. And the northern lights were visible. That's funny, I'd forgotten all about that. There was the flashes in the sky to the north, which was quite unusual. That was the first time I'd seen them since we had a magnificent displays over in Canada. And that was most noticeable over to the north.